and he asked the bigger boy his name.
"Manasseh," he replied.
"And what is your name?" he next asked the smaller one.
"Ephraim," was the reply.
"Ephraim and Manasseh," repeated the old man, naming first the name he had last heard. Then he held Ephraim at his right knee, and Manasseh at the other, caressed them, and corrected their Hebrew pronunciation.
"How often have I told you both," Joseph chid them, "to say it like that?"
"Ephraim and Manasseh cannot help it," said the old man. "Your own mouth, my son, is already a little wry. Do you want to grow into a multitude in the name of your father?" he asked the two.
"We should like to," answered Ephraim, who had remarked that he was the favorite.
And Jacob blessed them both for the time being. Next it was reported that Pharaoh had come to the dwelling of Re Horakte at On, and Joseph drove down to him, followed by the five chosen brethren. But Jacob was carried. Should anyone ask why he, the man of years and stateliness, was not the first to be received in audience by Pharaoh instead of the brothers, as we are told was the case, the answer is, for the sake of heightening the interest. In the ordering of any festal occasion, the best feature is seldom put first. It begins, as a rule, with some minor attraction. Then comes something a bit better, and only at the end does true excellence and honor come swaying up, while the crescendo of applause and shouting rises to its climax. This is an old dispute, the struggle for precedence, but from the ceremonial point of view, it was always an idle one. The poorer attraction has the pa. When it insists, its betters will always give way with a smile. Furthermore, the audience with the brothers had something practical in view. It was a business appointment, with a certain matter to discuss and settle. Whereas Jacob's presentation to the young god was merely a graceful formality, with so little content, indeed, that Pharaoh was graveled for lack of subject matter and hit on nothing better than to ask the patriarch how old he was. His talk with the sons had more sense. On the other hand, it was quite stereotyped, being, like all the king's audiences, arranged beforehand by his ministers. The five brothers were ushered by the mincing chamberlain into the council and audience chamber. Young Pharaoh sat there surrounded by a ring of standing palace officials. He bore the crook, the scourge, and a life symbol, and sat under a beribboned baldachin on a carved chair of the ancient and traditional uncomfortableness, yet he somehow contrived to relax and sit at ease in it, for he did not approve of the hieratic posture of the limbs, the stiffness of which he felt was out of harmony with the lovely naturalness of his god. His first mouthpiece, the Lord of the Bread, Jipnuti-Phonech, the provider, stood at the right forepost, and saw to it that the interview, which was conducted through an interpreter, ran off according to plan. The newcomers duly brought their foreheads into contact with the pavement of the hall. Then they mumbled a paean of adulation, not too long a one, having been drilled by Joseph, who had so composed it that it answered the court requirements without offending their own beliefs. It was not translated, being a mere introductory flourish. Pharaoh thanked them for it at once, in his shy treble, and added that His Majesty was sincerely glad to welcome before his throne the worthy relatives of his faithful shadow dispenser and uncle.
"What is your occupation?" he next inquired.
It was Judah who answered, saying that they were shepherds, both they and also their fathers, and they understood every sort of cattle breeding from the ground up. They had come hither to this country because there was no longer pasture for their flocks, the famine being sore in the land of Canaan. If they might venture a request before Pharaoh's countenance, it was this, that they might dwell in the land of Goshen, where they had for the time pitched their tent. Ikhnaton's sensitive face betrayed a faint distaste when the interpreter pronounced the word for shepherd. He turned to Joseph with the prescribed words, "Your kin have come unto you. The land of Egypt is before you and before them. In the best of the land make your father and your brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen they can dwell. It will be very agreeable to my majesty." Joseph prompted him by a glance, and he added, "My father, who is in heaven,
has also given my majesty an idea which the heart of Pharaoh rejoices in. You, my friend, know your brothers and their activities better than anyone else. You shall set them, according to their activities, over my flocks, and make them rulers over my cattle. My majesty graciously and cordially commands that the indentures be written out. I have been very much gratified. And next, it was Jacob's turn. His entrance was most stately and laboring. He deliberately exaggerated his age and infirmities that they might weigh down the balance against any Nimrod impressiveness and strengthen his guard not to give ground. He was perfectly aware that his courtier son was uneasy lest the father behave with condescension to Pharaoh or begin talking about the ram Bindidi. With filial concern, he had explicitly warned him against it. Jacob had no idea of doing so. On the other hand, he was determined to give no ground, and so set up as a defense this overpowering impression of great age. He had been dispensed from any genuflections, being presumably too stiff, and also it had been decided to make the audience very brief, to spare the old man long standing. They looked at each other for a while in silence. The luxurious young modern and dreamer of dreams about God, curiously rising a little out of his gilt and adorned little box and his over-easy posture, and Yitzhak's son, the father of 12. They looked at each other, all lapped in together as they were in this single hour, yet ages apart. The sickly boy, heir to an immemorial crown, striving with his feeble might to distill from millennial accumulations of religious thought the attar of a tender and sentimental religion of love, and the wise, experienced old man, whose position in time was at the very source and fount of widely developing being. Pharaoh soon became embarrassed. He was used to begin with the greeting hymn, according to protocol, and not to addressing the person who stood before him. But neither, we are told, was Jacob wholly unmindful of the opening formula, for on entering, as on leaving, he solemnly blessed Pharaoh. This must be taken quite literally. The patriarch substituted the blessing for the routine jingle of adulation, not lifting both hands, as he always did before his God, but only the right, stretching it straight out towards Pharaoh. It shook in the most impressive manner as he did it, as though from this distance he was putting a fatherly hand upon the young man's head. "May the Lord bless you, King over Egypt," he said, in the voice of advanced old age. Pharaoh was greatly impressed. "And how old might you be, little grandfather?" he inquired in amazement. And here again Jacob exaggerated. We are told that he reckoned his age at 130 years, an entirely arbitrary figure, for in the first place he did not know with any exactness. Even today, in his part of the world, people are not very clear on the point of age. And aside from that, we know that he was to live 106 years in all, an age within the bounds of the possible, if close to its extreme limit. And according to this reckoning, he had by now not yet reached 90. Though very well preserved for so considerable an age. But the question gave him a chance to clothe himself in the uttermost solemnity before Pharaoh. His gesture was that of a blind prophet, his speech deliberately measured. "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years, he said, and added, "Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Pharaoh shuddered. He was destined to die young, and his sensitive nature was attuned to the idea, so that the mere thought of all that mass of life seemed to horrify him. "Ye heavenly powers!" said he, in something like alarm. "And have you always lived at Hebron, little grandfather, in the wretched Retenu?" "Mostly, my child," answered Jacob, so that it went through the pleated one at the side of the canopy like a stroke. And Joseph shook his head warningly at his father. Jacob saw him, but pretended not to see. Obstinately continuing to bear down with all the oppressive evidence of age, he added,
2,300, according to the wise men, are the years of Hebron. And even Mempi, the city of tombs, does not go back so far.
Again Joseph hastily shook his head, but the old man paid not the least heed, and Pharaoh behaved with great compliance. It may be so, grandfather, it may be so, he hastened to say. But how can you call your lifetime evil when you begot a son whom Pharaoh loves as the apple of his eye, so that none is greater in the two lands save only the Lord of the Double Crown?
I begot 12 sons, answered Jacob, and he was one of their number. Among them is cursing as well as blessing, and blessing as well as cursing. Some have been rejected and remain the chosen, but as one has been chosen, he remains rejected in love. As I lost him, so should I find him. And as I found him, so was he lost to me. Upon a pedestal was he lifted up, and withdrew from among the number of those I begot. But in his stead there come in those whom he raised up to me. Before the one, the other.
Pharaoh listened with his mouth open to these sibylline remarks, which had become even more obscure by the time the interpreter finished with them. He looked imploringly at Joseph, but the latter kept his eyes cast down.
"Yes, yes," said he. "Of course, little grandfather, that is quite clear. Well and wisely said, as Pharaoh loves to have it. But now you must not tire yourself with standing longer before my majesty. Go in peace and live, so long as you have joy of it, years without number, added to your 130.
And Jacob blessed Pharaoh again with lifted hand, and then, having given ground by not even the thickness of a hair, he went hence out of his presence, with the same majestic formality and the same laboring gait as before. Of the Twinkling Eye. It may be in place here to set down a faithful account of Joseph's stewardship, in order once for all to take the ground from under the feet of the half-instructed chatterers whom we have always with us, very ready with their harsh judgment and abuse. The responsibility for these censures, which several times went so far as to use the word atrocious to describe Joseph's conduct of his office, must rest, the statement may not be shirked, first of all upon the earliest narration of the story, whose laconic style so little approaches the way in which it first told itself. I mean, in the happening realism of Once Upon a Time. They are hard, dry facts to which the first written account of the activities of Pharaoh's great man of business goes back. They give neither an idea of the general admiration which his measures originally called forth, nor any explanation of it, though it often came close to idolatry. Some of Joseph's titles, such as Provider and Lord of Bread, were taken quite literally by great masses of the people, who hazily thought of him as a sort of Nile deity, yes, an incarnation of Hapi himself, the preserver and life-giver. This legendary popularity which Joseph achieved, he had probably counted on it from the beginning, rested most of all on the mixed and changeable character of his technique, which operated, as it were, on two planes, in a way quite peculiar to him. In short, he used the magic of his wit to reconcile conflicting aims. I use the word wit because this principle has its place in the little cosmos of our tale, and quite early on it was said that wit is of the nature of a messenger to and fro and of a go-between betwixt opposed spheres and influences. For instance, between the power of the sun and of the moon, between father and mother inheritance, between the blessing of the day and the blessing of the night. Yes, to put it directly and succinctly, between life and death. This spirit of mediation, brisk, blithe, and nimble at its reconciling task, was not represented by any deity in the pantheon of Joseph's adopted country, the land of the black earth. Tote,
the scribe and guide of the dead, inventor of manifold skills, comes closest to it. Pharaoh only, before whom information about the divine was born from distant lands, Pharaoh had inklings of a more consummate development of this god-nature. In fact, the favor Joseph found in his eyes was due preponderantly to the circumstance that Pharaoh had recognized in him traits of the adroit child of the cave, the master of pranks, and rightly said to himself that no king could wish better for himself than to have as his minister a manifestation and incarnation of this most happy god-nature. It was in the form of Joseph himself that the children of Egypt got acquainted with the winged figure. If they did not take it into their pantheon, it was only because the place was occupied by Jehuti, the white ape. However, the experience meant for them an enrichment of their religion in a certain field, and a highly diverting experience as well. I mean, in the field of magic. And the change their legendary conception of it underwent, to their own great amazement. To the children of Egypt, magic was a serious and solemn business, and gave them much concern. Its office was to build up walls against the dragon of evil, walls as thick as possible, in order to fend it off and prevent its penetration. That was all the meaning the word had for them, and in that light they saw Joseph's preparations against famine, his hoarding of grain, the host of bins he built. But now, for the first time, they were seeing magic as a conjunction of evil and foresight. I mean this, that the shadow dispenser, thanks to his foresight, led the dragon by the nose, made it serve their profit and advantage in purposes which the dragon, bent only on destruction, could never have thought of. This was magic married to enlightenment and good cheer. It made the children of Egypt laugh instead of cry. In fact, there was much laughter among the people, admiring laughter, at the way in which Joseph coolly exploited the price situation in dealing with the rich and great to the advantage of his master, Hor in the palace, making him gold and silver by pouring vast sums into Pharaoh's treasury in exchange for the corn he gave the property owners. He was displaying therein a shrewd loyalty to the divine, which is the essence of all dutiful, devoted, and rewarding service. But hand in hand with this service went the free distribution of grain among the hungry little people of the cities, in the name of young Pharaoh, the god-dreamer, to whom thus accrued as much and even more profit than to Joseph by his gilding. It was a combination of crown politics and concern for the little man, a novel, ingenious, and invigorating policy, the attractiveness of which can be gathered from the original narrator only by those who study his style with some care and know how to read between the lines. The relation of our source to its own original, I mean the self-narrating events themselves, is betrayed by certain crude phrases of comic relief, which seem like survivals of a popular farce. Through these, the character of the original events faintly glimmers. For instance, when the famished folk cried before Joseph, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence, for that the money faileth?" A very poor way of talking, which does not occur elsewhere in the Pentateuch. But Joseph answered in the same style, namely with the words, "Give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money fails." Of course, the needy folk and Pharaoh's great keeper of the market did not treat in this key. Rather, the style is reminiscent of the mood in which the people experienced the actual event, a farcical mood quite devoid of moral self-pity. Still, the venerable document has not been able to stand aloof from the reproach of exploitation and harshness in Joseph's proceedings. Indeed, it has evoked the moral condemnation of serious minds, and quite naturally. We learn that Joseph, in the course of the years of the lean years, first gathered all the money in the country unto himself, that is, into Pharaoh's treasury, then took the people's cattle in pawn, and then their lands, and finally drove them from hearth and home, sent them to work on strange soil as servants of the state. It is an unpleasant hearing. But the actual situation was quite different, as we can glean from certain remarkable turns of phrase. One reads, "He gave them bread in exchange for horses, and for the flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for the asses. and he fed them with bread for all the cattle of that year. But the translation is inexact, and makes us miss a certain reference which the original does not neglect to give. For instead of fed, there is a word which means led. And led them, it says, with bread for all their cattle for that year. It is an odd expression, and was deliberately chosen, for it is taken from shepherd's language, and means protect or pasture, the gentle and careful tendance of helpless creatures, especially of an easily frightened flock of sheep. For an ear practiced in mythology, the role and quality of the good shepherd is ascribed to the son of Jacob in these striking and traditional words. The shepherd who guards the sheep and leads them upon green meadows and to fresh waters. Here, as in the conventional comedy phrase quoted above, the color of the original happening strikes through. This strange word, led, which has, as it were, slipped out of reality into the narrative text, betrays the light in which the people saw Pharaoh's great favorite. Their judgment is quite distinct from that which state moralists think today to pass upon him, for cherishing, feeding, and leading are the activities of a god known as Lord of the Under-Earthly Sheepfold.